Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
It's almost poetic how in a trial packed with accusations, finger pointing, and social media noise, it was a silent, frozen cell phone that ended up doing the loudest talking. If you were looking for a dramatic turn in the Karen Reed trial today, well, it certainly gave us some twists. It didn't come from some fiery witness shouting from the stand. It came from a forensic nerd with a laser pointer, a couple of maps, and some data that might punch a giant hole straight through the defense's theory. Prosecution expert Ian Whiffen, a digital forensic analyst from Cellebrite, the people who basically live inside your phone's brain, took to the stand this morning and walked the jury through exactly what John O'Keefe's cell phone was doing the night he died. Spoiler alert, it wasn't moving. According to Whiffen's analysis, sometime around 12:24 a.m., O'Keefe's phone hitched its last ride over to 34 Fairview Road, the house where a boozy gathering of off-duty cops and their friends was allegedly happening. But here's the thing. After it arrived, the phone did not go inside the house. It didn't move up the driveway. It didn't even take a stroll to the back patio for one of those late-night beer-in-hand smoke breaks. No. It pretty much stopped dead about 30 feet from the front door, right near the flagpole in the snowy yard. And it stayed there for hours until sunrise, until someone found it by his body. Now, you might think, okay, maybe the phone stayed out, but John didn't. Maybe he dropped it, right? Maybe he wandered off without it. Fair question. But Whiffen didn't stop at the location dots. He pulled up the phone's battery temperature logs. And that's where it gets even harder to argue. At 12:13 a.m., the phone's internal battery temp was a cozy 82 degrees, basically what you'd expect for a phone tucked inside a warm pocket or car. By 12:45 a.m., the temperature had nosedived to 66 degrees. For a phone to cool off that fast, it would have had to leave a heated environment and sit outside in the cold. In this case, a Massachusetts snowstorm hovering somewhere around 10 degrees that night. Ever left your phone on your car seat overnight in the middle of winter and found it frozen stiff like a popsicle in the morning? You get the idea. The prosecution painted it simply. O'Keefe's phone didn't just stay outside, it froze there. Just like he allegedly did. Another hammer blow came with the timeline of the phone's activity. Whiffen testified that the phone was unlocked for the last time at 12:32 a.m. After that, radio silence. It's like John O'Keefe or whoever was holding the phone, if anyone was, just disappeared. No text sent, no calls answered, no frantic scrolling through Instagram at 2 a.m. looking for bad life advice. Just nothing. Meanwhile, starting at 12:33 a.m., Karen Reed's calls began rolling in. Missed call after missed call unanswered, piling up into the early morning. And all the while, the phone stayed pinned in the same frigid spot. Its GPS signals stubborn and unchanging. It was a tidy little forensic package. Phone arrives at the yard. Phone freezes with the battery cooling. Phone never moves. Nobody answers anything. The jury probably felt a lot like one of those connect the dot puzzles you finish in 5 seconds and wonder why you even bothered. But the prosecution wasn't done. They knew one thorn was still sticking out. The infamous Jennifer McCabe Google search. If you follow this case at all, you knew this search is one of the defense's pet arguments. McCabe, who was hanging out with Karen Reed during the frantic overnight search for O'Keefe that morning, allegedly Googled "How's long to die in cold" at 2:27 a.m., hours before they found his body, hours before they started looking for his body. The implication is Jennifer McCabe somehow knew that her friend, John O'Keefe, was dying in the front yard, laying there while checking basketball information for her daughter, and then just casually going, I wonder how long for John to die in the snow that he's sitting out there in. And then go to bed. Seems logical, right? That's who doesn't do that? The defense has been waving that around like a giant neon sign, suggesting it proves McCabe knew he was dead long before she should have. In their version of things, that search is a smoking gun, except it turns out iPhones are weirder than you think. According to Whiffen, the forensic dive into McCabe's device showed that the search didn't actually happen at 2:27 a.m. Not really. Instead, what happened was this. McCabe had a browser tab open around 2:27 a.m. She was apparently looking at a local sports scoreboard or basketball page or something like that, and left that tab open, probably minimizing the background. Hours later, about 6:23 a.m., after O'Keefe's body had been found in the chaos that it was settling in, she used that same old tab to type in her desperate cold weather search. Because of how iPhones log activity under the original tab opening time, not when the new search actually happens, and he explains it in great detail in court, far, far more scientific than this, it made it look like she Googled way earlier than she actually did. In other words, the defense's neon sign just shorted out. And for bonus points, Whiffen testified that the records showing the Google search had later been wiped from the browsing history, but not manually. It wasn't McCabe deleting her dirty little secrets with the guilty thumb swipe. It was the iPhone system doing what it does on the regular, cleaning up background junk nobody's looked at in a few days. So nobody was hiding anything. Whiffen didn't find a shred of evidence suggesting McCabe intentionally deleted anything. For the defense, it was like watching the sandcastle kind of get, you know, flattened by a slow rising tide. Speaking of the defense, they finally got their shot at Whiffen right before lunch. Defense attorney Robert Alessi tried to chip away at the phone data, suggesting that there were moments where the phone's orientation might have changed, maybe hinting at movement towards the house. He also pointed to a 7-second call McCabe made to O'Keefe's number, maybe trying to introduce some doubt about who knew what and when. But Whiffen wasn't rattled. He stuck to the basics. The phone stayed outside. It stayed near the flagpole, and it stayed cold and lifeless up until the sun came up. By the time court broke for lunch, Alessi's cross-examination was still dragging on, unfinished, which means Whiffen's time on the stand isn't over yet. He'll be back when court resumes, still facing the defense's attempts to bend that immovable phone data into something, anything more favorable to Reed. But make no mistake, today's testimony didn't just hand the prosecution a win, it changed the tone of the trial. Up until now, it's been Karen Reed's team throwing bombs, waving their third-party culprit like a flag, pointing fingers at supposed police cover-ups. Today, the prosecution showed up with cold, silent, scientific receipts. No yelling, no conspiracy theories, just a frozen phone under a flagpole, telling a story that might be harder and harder for the defense to just explain away. And while the digital evidence left a heavy mark, the real fireworks were only just getting started. Because once the tech nerds stepped off the field, the courtroom became a battleground over the defense's own experts and whether they were even playing fair in the first place. The courtroom had barely cooled off from the digital forensics bombshells when it lurched into a whole new fight. This time, the jury was politely shown the door. What unfolded after lunch wasn't about frozen phones or snowy yards. It was about people, specifically whether two of the defense's prized expert witnesses were actually playing for the wrong team. The afternoon session belonged to Daniel Wolf and, by extension, Andrew Rentschler, two crash construction experts from ARCA, a forensic engineering company the defense had learned and leaned into to argue that John O'Keefe and his injuries didn't match being struck by a car. If you were Karen Reed, these guys were supposed to be your aces in the hole. But by the time court adjourned for the day, they looked a lot more like wild cards that might blow up in their hand. Before anything could happen, Judge Beverly Cannone ordered a voir dire, basically a mini-hearing without the jury, to figure out whether Wolf and Rechner should even be allowed to testify. This wasn't just some procedural technicality. It was a direct result of the defense allegedly failing to turn over critical communications between these experts and Reed's lawyers, and prosecutors were chomping at the bit to show the whole thing stunk worse than last week's seafood at the discount sushi restaurant. Never go to a discount sushi restaurant. That's your life tip of the day. Special Prosecutor Hank Brennan, who had already proven earlier in the day that he could flay a technical witness without breaking a sweat, took the lead. Right out of the gate, he started digging into Wolf's relationship with defense attorney Alan Jackson. And it didn't take long before the words "deleted messages" started hanging in the air, like kind of a bad smell. Wolf, to his credit, didn't dance around it. He admitted that after the first trial, that one that ended with a mistrial, he deleted roughly about 100 or so text messages that he had exchanged with Jackson. His explanation was almost casual. He was like talking about cleaning out old pizza coupons from his inbox. He said he routinely deletes texts once a case wraps up, and it was just his habit. Nothing shady intended, but Brennan was not buying it. And frankly, you could feel the room tightening the longer Wolf spoke. Deleting texts between a defense expert and a defense attorney in a high-profile murder trial isn't exactly like emptying your spam folder. Wolf also admitted that at some point in March of 25, he and Jackson started communicating over Signal, an encrypted messaging app, famous for wiping messages clean after the read. According to Wolf, Jackson was the one who requested they use Signal. No emails, no saved chat logs, just whispers into the void. Now, in some corners of the world, using encrypted apps is just being careful. In a courtroom, it looks a lot like you're trying to hide something, but people do use it all the time. And hiding things, or at least the appearance of it, was exactly what Brennan hammered home next. He introduced a series of messages and emails Wolf had exchanged with the defense, messages that didn't just look casual, they looked strategic. In one, Wolf floated, "Not sure if you want to put this somewhere in the direct examination," like he was prepping the defense on how to roll out a testimony or something like that. In another, he warned the lawyers that the prosecution might argue he hadn't personally inspected the vehicle involved, basically helping them predict the cross-examination angles before they even hit the stand. Put it bluntly, Wolf wasn't just doing forensic analysis. Seemed like he was coaching. But did he even know he was, I think, is the real question. I don't know. I don't know that he knew he was. I think he was doing what he thought he should be doing. I think it's only later that blew up more, and, you know, the defense for Karen Reed knew that they were doing bad things, but didn't want to tell the participant in the bad things that he was doing bad things. I don't know. Still hammering my way through this one. Brennan didn't let up. He leaned into the financials, revealing that Wolf
and his firm had already billed Reed's defense team nearly $24,000 for their work on the case. And sure, experts get paid. Nobody expects them to work for hugs and gratitude. But when you add up a hefty paycheck to selective communication and deleted evidence, it paints a picture prosecutors were more than happy to frame in front of the judge. At one point, Brennan cut to the chase and asked Wolf directly if he considered himself an advocate for the defense. Wolf stiffened and said no, insisting he was only an advocate for his own analysis, for the truth as he found it. Brennan didn't buy that either. He fired back with one of the most memorable lines of the day. When Wolf tried to say his communications were all about helping the jury understand technical material, Brennan snapped back, "Don't hide behind the jury." It was sharp, it was public, and it made Wolf look like a man with nowhere clean to stand. For his part, Wolf tried to offer some personal context. He told the court that he faced a wave of harassment after his testimony in the first trial, people posting pictures of his children online, people showing up at his business. He said he reached out to Alan Jackson for reassurance, not strategy. It was a human move, not a legal one. And maybe that's true. Maybe it was. But even with that sympathetic backdrop, the facts remained the same. He'd deleted communications, he'd used encrypted messaging, and he'd offered strategic advice to the defense team. Again, did he know he was doing anything bad? I think that's a big question. As the hearing dragged into the late afternoon, the cracks in the defense's expert lineup only grew wider. Andrew Rechner, the other ARCA expert, was briefly called, but the focus stayed locked on Wolf, who had clearly become the symbol of the bigger problem. Was the defense presenting neutral, independent experts to the jury, or were they quietly slipping in a second defense team disguised as scientists? Judge Cannone did not issue any ruling before the court wrapped up for the day. No dramatic hammer dropping, no verdict on whether Wolf and Rechner would get to testify in full, but she had seen and heard plenty. So had everyone else in the room. Whether or not a formal decision came down yet, the damage was already done. The defense's credibility, the idea that they were marching into court armed with independent scientific truth, it had taken a real visible hit. And it wasn't because the prosecution found some obscure technical error in their analysis. It was because the defense's own experts had gotten too cozy, too casual, and too close. As the courtroom cleared and the lawyers packed up their bags, it was clear the trial had entered a new phase. No longer was it just a battle over what happened in the snow outside 34 Fairview Road. It was a battle over who could be trusted to even tell the story at all. And just as those internal cracks widened, events outside the courtroom and even within the jury itself were quietly setting up even bigger tremors that no one inside the courthouse could ignore. The courtroom fights are usually what grab all the headlines, the experts battling it out, the lawyers sparring over who can say what, but sometimes the biggest punches in a trial happen quietly, without a single raised voice. Today, it's exactly what happened in the Karen Reed trial. While the experts were still dusting themselves off with the afternoon brawl, a few quiet but serious moments unfolded, ones that might matter just as much, if not more, than any piece of testimony, but who knows. It started right before lunch. Out of nowhere, Judge Beverly Cannone called one of the jurors up to the bench for a private conversation. It was a male juror, someone who until that moment had blended in with the group, asking no questions, raising no alarms. But whatever he said up there, whatever concern or issue he brought to light, it was enough that after the lunch break, he simply did not come back. No official statement was made in the open court. No explanation was offered to the public or even the other jurors, at least not that anyone could see. He was just gone. Now, under normal circumstances, a juror disappearing mid-trial is a big deal. It raises questions. Did he get sick? Did he reveal a bias that hadn't come out in the jury selection? Did something outside the courtroom interfere? And they're all fair questions. But here's the important thing. Nobody, and I mean nobody, from the court has officially confirmed yet why he left or if he is formally even excused. It was just a big silent blank spot where a juror used to be. What we do know is that Karen Reed's trial started with 18 jurors, 12 primary, 6 alternates, precisely for this reason. This happens. And if this man was dismissed, an alternate would very easily, quietly slide into his place. No disruptions, no need to hit the reset button. It's still a tremor under the floorboards of a case where every inch of ground kind of feels like it matters. And if that wasn't enough seismic movement for the day, something even bigger hit from outside the courthouse walls, something that came all the way from Washington, D.C. I don't know why we amped that up to feel like it was some sort of like WrestleFest or something. Washington, D.C. And this one, I would say, is fairly predictable. But, you know, stranger things have happened. It came from the highest court in the country. Karen Reed's team had gambled big when they filed an appeal to the United States Supreme Court, arguing that her retrial was unconstitutional. Their claim hinged on what happened after the first trial ended in a mistrial last year behind closed doors. In a conference with the judge, the first jury allegedly revealed that they had unanimously voted to acquit Karen Reed of two of the most serious charges, second-degree murder and leaving the scene of a personal injury and death. They were hung on the lesser charge of manslaughter, but because no verdict was ever formally entered into the record, because the jury never announced anything publicly, the legal reality was simple. A hung jury is a hung jury. No verdict, no acquittal, no protections, no do-overs. Still, Reed's team pushed the argument that it was unfair, even unconstitutional, to try her again on charges that the first jury had, at least allegedly, already rejected. They took that argument to the Massachusetts Appeals Court, where it was shot down. They pushed it to the state's highest court, which also said, sorry. And finally, they asked the United States Supreme Court to weigh in. If the Supreme Court had agreed with them, Karen Reed could have seen her second-degree murder charge and hit-and-run charge thrown out entirely, before the jury even heard a word of testimony. But today, the Supreme Court quietly closed that door for good. In a short order, without explanation, as their standard practice is, they declined to take up her case. No hearing, no written opinions, just a one-line denial. What that means in plain English is simple. Karen Reed now faces every single charge, just like she has been. Full force, no shortcuts, no easy outs, second-degree murder, leaving the scene, manslaughter, all of it. It was a devastating blow for the defense. Well, they probably saw it coming, let's be honest. It's one that landed with almost no noise, but did carry massive consequences. That Hail Mary was out. No touchdown. They can no longer argue that some of the charges are off limits. They can't even raise the issue in front of the jury. As far as the trial is concerned, it's as if the first jury's alleged opinions never existed. That's how this works. The retrial is a full reset, and the stakes, if they weren't already sky high, they just got ratcheted up another notch. Outside of the courthouse, though, you wouldn't know it. As from looking at Karen Reed as she walked out past reporters and supporters, she wore the same defiant expression. That's become almost a trademark at this point. And she didn't just walk by silently. She spoke up. "Nothing's breaking me," she told cameras, allegedly, voice steady, eyes hard. Whatever had just happened with the Supreme Court, whatever bad news her legal team had just absorbed, she wasn't showing even a crack. She also made sure to double down on her vision of the digital evidence story. Cellbrite says 227, and it was deleted. She allegedly said, a reference to the earlier courtroom discussion about Jennifer McCabe's Google search and the debate over when it was actually performed. To Reed and her supporters, that search remains one of the cornerstone arguments of her innocence, a puzzle piece that, in their view, points to someone else knowing John O'Keefe was dead long before the official discovery. Even when you have experts who have nothing in this game telling you you're wrong, you're just interpreting the data wrong. And here's why. And he went into a very detailed explanation today showing exactly how and why. It is what it is. Evidence doesn't always fall into your corner and you get exactly what you wanted. The solution isn't continuing to stomp your feet and go, "I don't believe it, I don't believe it, I don't believe it, la 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 la, I don't believe it." But in a lot of trials, it is. Inside and outside the courthouse, the mood by late afternoon, it was tense, really tense. The prosecution had just put together one of its strongest days yet, locking down scientific evidence through Whiffen's methodical testimony, exposing serious credibility problems in the defense's crash experts, and now gaining the psychological edge of winning a major Supreme Court appeal crash and burn. Meanwhile, the defense looked like it was scrambling a bit, trying to patch holes on multiple fronts all at once. Observers from the press gallery noted the shift in the atmosphere, too. What had started as a trial with massive energy on the defense side, lots of momentum, lots of confidence, lots of public sympathy, now felt like it was tilting back the other way. Not in some massive landslide, but in a slow, grinding pivot that you could feel in the way the courtroom buzzed during breaks. Supporters of Karen Reed still showed up, still held signs, still stood on the courtroom steps, or courthouse steps. But inside the courtroom, where the only voices that mattered belonged to the lawyers, the experts, and the judge, it was clear today belonged to the prosecution. And no matter how many times Karen Reed says she won't break, the legal landscape around her just got a lot rougher. There's going to be a lot more coming up. Witnesses, maybe, just maybe, a clearer sense of whether the cracks forming today can be paved over, or whether they're the kind that split a case right down the middle. What do you think about today? Tell me in the comments section on YouTube. Love to see that. If you're listening to this podcast, wherever it may be, check out our YouTube channel, Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Just search that, you'll find it. And you can join in our conversations and all of our podcasts and the videos. Everything we do here, we put out on video as well on YouTube. So you can watch us do this stuff too. And watch me wave my pen around in animated ways when I tell these stories. Anyway. Do check that out. Press subscribe, like I said, wherever you're getting us, YouTube, podcast platforms, whatever it may be. And like I said, comment. Love to hear your feedback on the case. It's getting crazier, and it will continue to do so for many days forward. I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. She was a doting mother, the kind who baked cookies, made the best homemade Halloween costumes, and never missed a PTA meeting. The perfect mom. Until the police found something buried in the backyard. A secret she kept for years. A secret she thought would never come to light. The neighbors gasped. Not her. She's so nice. But people forget. Monsters don't always look like monsters. Some wear aprons. Some tuck their kids in at night. And some hide their darkest deeds in places they think no one will ever look. If only someone had heard the warning signs, had recognized the patterns from an eerily similar case on Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. If they had only subscribed to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts, they could have listened ad-free before anyone else and saved themselves from baking cookies with a serial killer. Instead, well, they won't be RSVP to this year's PTA meeting. Subscribe now to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.